and on the gas. I couldn't live with that. As his lawyer, I would spend his last moments with him in the holding room next door to the gas chamber, probably with a minister or a chaplain, and then they would take him away. I would walk around a corner to a witness room and sit with Gwen, his wife, and Lester, his brother, and probably other family members, and we would watch him die. I lost sleep with those nightmares. I studied the history of the death penalty really for the first time in my life and saw the obvious problems, the unfairness, the inequalities, the waste of time, money, and lives. I'm also struck by the moral quandary. We treasure life and can all agree that it is wrong to kill. So why do we allow ourselves through the state to legally kill people? So I changed my mind. I guess it's part of growing up, of living, of maturing. It's only natural to question our beliefs. Claude practically tossed the two baskets on the table and said, "You got 30 minutes. 45, Jake said, but he was already gone. "Why do so many white people love the death penalty?" Portia asked. "It's in the water. We grow up with it. We hear it at home, at church, at school, among friends. This is the Bible Belt, Portia. Eye for an eye and all that." "What about the New Testament and Jesus' sermons on forgiveness?" "It's not convenient. He also preached love first, tolerance, acceptance, equality. But most Christians I know are quite good at cherry-picking their way through the Holy Scriptures." "And not just white Christians," she said with a laugh. They ate for a few minutes and enjoyed Claude's verbal assaults on three black gentlemen in nice suits. One made the mistake of asking to see a menu. They were laughing by the time the abuse was over. All tables were taken by 12:15, and Jake counted seven other white folks, not that it mattered. For a brief interlude, good food was more important than skin color. Portia ate in small bites with perfect manners. She was 26 now, and thanks to the army, had seen more of the world than Jake or anyone he knew. She was also having trouble finding a suitable boyfriend. "You got a boy?" he asked, looking for trouble. "No, and don't ask." She took a bite and looked around. "What are the prospects in law school? Black or white?" "Come on, Jake. If I brought a white boy home, my family would go nuts. Surely there'll be some talent in law school."
"I doubt it. I finished 12 years ago, and we had three blacks in our class."
"Let's talk about something else," she said. "You sound like Mama, always pecking away about me not getting married. I remind her that she got married, and look how that turned out."
Her father, Simeon Lang, had a rough history and was currently serving time for vehicular homicide. Her mother, Letty, had divorced him 2 years earlier. Claude walked by and frowned at their baskets. He glanced at his wristwatch as if they were out of time. "How are we supposed to enjoy lunch under this much pressure?" Jake asked him.
"You're doing a pretty good job. Hurry up, though. I got folks waiting outside."
They finished, and Jake left a $20 bill on the table. Claude did not accept credit cards or checks, and the town loved to speculate about how much money he made. He had a nice house in the country, drove a beautiful Cadillac, and had sent three kids to college. It was generally assumed that his disdain for printed menus, receipts, and credit cards also extended to the notion of income taxation. On the sidewalk, Jake said, "I think I'll walk over to the jail and sit with Drew for an hour or so. Kid's cleaning my clock in blackjack, and I need to get my money back."
"Such a sweet boy. Can't we get him out, Jake?"
"It's not likely. Can you visit him tomorrow? He really likes you, Portia."
"Sure. I'll make some brownies and take him over. The jailers love my double fudge. Not that they need any."
"I'll be back in a couple of hours.
Whatever, Jake. You're the boss. For now, anyway.
Chapter 52. Monday morning, Jake finished tallying up his hours and expenses for the defense of Drew Gamble and faxed his bill to the Honorable Omar Noose. Since the judge's first phone call on Sunday, March 25th, the actual date of Stuart Kofor's death, Jake detailed 320 hours, or about a third of his total time. He added 100 hours for Porsche's work, and he billed every possible minute related to the case, driving time, phone time, everything. He padded his timesheets generously and did so with no guilt. The approved rate for court-appointed work was only $50 an hour, a paltry sum for any lawyer's time. The most expensive attorney in town was rumored to be Walter Sullivan, who boasted of charging $200 an hour. The corporate firms in Jackson and Memphis were billing as much. 2 years earlier, in the Seth Hubbard will contest, Judge Attlee had approved $150 an hour for Jake, and he considered himself worth every penny. $50 an hour barely covered his overhead. His total was $21,000, or $20,000 more than the statute allowed for capital murder, and as he submitted it, he doubted he would ever see the money. For that reason alone, the thought of a retrial was depressing. What was a reasonable fee? It was difficult to say because people of means were rarely indicted for murder. 3 years earlier, a wealthy farmer over in the Delta was charged with killing his wife with a 12-gauge. He hired a well-known trial lawyer and was acquitted. The fee was rumored to have been $250,000. Those were the cases Jake wanted. 30 minutes later, Judge Noose was on the phone. Jake swallowed hard and took the call.
"Seems reasonable to me," His Honor said. "You did a fine job, Jake."
Relieved, Jake thanked him and asked, "What's next, Judge?"
"I'm faxing your bill to Todd Tannehill right now with instructions to tell the board to write a check. Give 'em hell, Judge."
He thanked him again and hung up. The board would decline, and the plan was for Jake to then sue the county in circuit court, Omar Noose presiding. An hour later, Todd Tannehill called. Todd was a good lawyer and had been the attorney for the Board of Supervisors for many years. Jake had always liked him, and they had even gone duck hunting together. Todd said,
"Congratulations on the win, Jake."
"Thanks, but it's only temporary."
"Yeah, I know. Look, the fee is quite reasonable, and I'd love to write you a check, but there's this statute staring us in the face."
"I'm looking at it, too."
"Well, I'll submit the bill, the board meets this afternoon, and I'll put this at the top of the agenda. But we both know the board will decline. Noose said you'll probably sue the county."
"That's always an option."
"Good luck. I'll get the ball rolling."
Tuesday morning, Jake received a faxed letter from Tannehill. "Dear Mr. Brigance, on Monday, August 13th, the Ford County Board of Supervisors was presented with a bill for your court-appointed services in the defense of Drew Gamble. Your request exceeds the amount authorized by state law. Therefore, the board has no choice but to decline to pay your bill. At your request, the board will pay the statutory maximum of $1,000. Regretfully, Todd Tannehill." Jake prepared a simple one-page lawsuit against the county and showed it to Lucian, who was in his room downstairs. He loved it and said,
"Well, if these God-fearing creatures around here love the death penalty so much, they can certainly pay for it."
Because Dumas Lee combed the court records each Tuesday afternoon in search of news, Jake decided to wait a day or so before filing. The newspaper went to press at 10 each Tuesday night, and the next day's edition would undoubtedly scream about the mistrial in the Kofor murder. A story about Jake suing the county for his fees would just add fuel
to the fire. Lowell Dyer showed no such restraint. On Tuesday afternoon, he convened the grand jury in a special session and walked them through the murder once again. Ozzie testified and produced the same crime scene photos. In a unanimous vote, Drew Gamble was re-indicted for capital murder and served with papers in his cell. Dyer called Jake afterward, and the conversation was tense. Not that the timing really mattered. The fresh indictment was expected, and with a possible re-election looming, Dyer needed to do something dramatic to mitigate his defeat. Early Wednesday morning, Jake read the Times over coffee with Carla. There was hardly enough room on the front page for all the bold headlines about the hung jury and the photos and the breathless reporting by Dumas. The new indictment was on page 2. Still no comment from Mr. Brigantz. On Thursday morning, Jake filed his lawsuit against the county. He also sued the estate of Stuart Kofer for $50,000 for Josie's medical bills, along with some extra for her pain and suffering. Two other lawsuits were being discussed around the office. One was his own against Cecil Kofer for medical expenses from the beating. The other was another suit against Stuart's estate for Kira's care and treatment, as well as support for her child, yet unborn. The suing was therapeutic. Portia was cooking up a lawsuit of her own. Jake, like most small-town practitioners, never dealt with habeas corpus cases. Habeas work was almost exclusively done by lawyers representing prisoners claiming to be wrongfully detained, and virtually all of it was in federal court. But as she learned, there was no prohibition against seeking habeas relief in state court. Late Thursday, she presented Jake with a lawsuit and a thick brief to support it. He looked at the heading, Drew Allen Gamble versus Ozzie Walls, Sheriff of Ford County, and said with a smile, "We're suing Ozzie now?" "That's right. Habeas lawsuits are filed against the person holding the plaintiff. It's usually the warden of some prison." "That should make his day." "He's not on the hook for any damages. It's more of a formality." "And in state court?" "That's right. We have to exhaust all state remedies before we can go to federal court." Jake read on, smiling. The lawsuit alleged that Drew was being unlawfully detained because the court, Judge Noose, considered the charge of capital murder to be a non-bailable offense. He had served over 4 months in the county jail while presumably innocent. The state had tried to convict him and failed. Because of his age, he was being held in solitary confinement and being denied educational opportunities. "I love it," Jake mumbled as he read. Portia beamed proudly at her handiwork. At the rate Jake was suing, there was little doubt he would file it promptly. Ford County and the 22nd Circuit Court were violating the Eighth Amendment's prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment by incarcerating a minor in an adult jail with no chance of making bail. Jake put down the lawsuit and picked up her supporting brief. As he began to read it, she said, "It's just a rough draft. Still got some work to do." "It's brilliant. You don't need law school." "Great, just get me a license." He read slowly, flipping the pages, kept smiling. When he finished, she handed him more papers. "What's this?" he asked.
"The federal lawsuit. Once Noose says no, then we run to federal court, where the judges know a lot more about habeas corpus."
"Yeah, they hate it."
"True, but they hate it because they are inundated with filings from jailhouse lawyers who have little else to do. Every inmate has a beef, whether it's a legitimate claim of innocence or a rant about leaky toilets and bad food, so they flood the courts with habeas petitions. This is different and might just be taken seriously."
"Same allegations?"
"Yes, pretty much the same lawsuit."
Jake put it down and stood and stretched. She watched him and said,
"And I think you should ask Noose to recuse himself. After all, he's part of the problem because he won't consider an appropriate bond. We should ask for another judge, one from outside the district."
"Oh, that'll make him happy. Here's an idea. I have a meeting with Noose in the morning, with Dyer, post-trial stuff. He's in town for first appearances and bail hearings. What if I show him and Dyer the habeas petition with the brief and threaten to file it here, then take it to federal court if necessary?"
"Has he ever seen a habeas petition?"
"I doubt it. I'll suggest a recusal and demand an expedited hearing. He knows it'll get to the press, and he might want to avoid the hassle. Dyer can bitch and moan and posture for the public. The end game is to pressure Noose to set a reasonable bond so our client can bail out."
"How can Drew afford any bond?"
"Great question. Let's worry about that when the time comes." Chapter 53. The courtroom was busy at 9 on Friday morning as lawyers milled about and gossiped and told stale jokes. Families of freshly indicted young men watched from the pews and worried. Clerks scurried about with paperwork and flirted with the lawyers. Jake was the man of the hour, and several of his rivals were forced to offer congratulations on the win over in Chester. This stopped, however, when Lowell Dyer arrived on behalf of the state. A bailiff fetched Jake and Todd Tannehill and said his honor wanted them in chambers. Noose was waiting, standing and stretching, and in obvious discomfort when they walked in. He greeted them warmly with handshakes all around and pointed to the chairs at the table. When seated, he said,
"We have a busy docket this morning, gentlemen, so let's get right to the point. Jake, you filed your lawsuit for your fees. Todd, how soon can you file your answer?"
"Real soon, Judge."
"I'm afraid that's not good enough. The complaint is a simple one-pager, a real rarity in this business, with Jake's bill attached. I'm sure your answer will be even briefer. Denials all around, right?"
"Afraid so, Judge."
"You've consulted with your clients, and I assume all five supervisors are in agreement?"
"Yes, sir."
"Good. I want you to hustle back to your office, prepare a one-page answer, bring it back over here, and file it while I work through my docket."
"File it today?"
"No, sir. File it before lunch. The trial will be set for next Thursday in this courtroom, a bench trial, with me presiding. Jake, do you anticipate calling any witnesses?"
"No, sir. I really don't need any."
"Nor do you, Todd. It will be a very short trial. I want all five of the supervisors in the courtroom. Jake, subpoena them if you have to."
"That won't be necessary, Your Honor,"
Todd said.
"I'll get them here."
"Okay, but if one fails to show, then I'll issue a warrant."
Todd was taken aback, as was Jake. The idea of arresting an elected county supervisor and hauling him into the courtroom was startling. Noose wasn't finished.
"And Todd, I suggest that you quietly remind the five that there are two lawsuits pending in this court in which Ford County is the primary defendant. One involves a contaminated landfill owned by the county and alleged to have polluted some drinking water. The plaintiffs are asking for a lot of money. The second concerns an accident involving a county dump truck. Both claims appear to have merit. I want Jake to get paid. The county has the money because I've seen the books. They are, as you know, public record."
Even more startling was the less than subtle threat by a presiding judge to show favor in unrelated cases. Tannehill was stunned and said,
"Judge, pardon me, but that sounds like a threat."
"It's not a threat. It's a promise. I dragged Jake into the gamble case with the assurance that he would get paid. His fees are reasonable, don't you agree?"
"I have no problem with his fees. It's just that—"
I know. But county supervisors have wide latitude in budgetary matters, and they can pay this money out of unrestricted funds. Let's get it done.
Okay. Okay.
You're dismissed, Todd. Please file your answer before noon.
Tannehill shot Jake a bewildered look, then scurried out of the room. When he was gone, Noose stood and stretched again.
How many cases do you have this morning?
2 first appearances plus gamble. I don't suppose you want him in court today.
No, we'll do it later. Let's get through the morning's business and meet back here for lunch with Lowell.
Sure, Judge.
And Jake, order us some catfish po' boys from Claws, okay?
You got it, Judge. The lawyers took off their jackets and loosened their ties at His Honor's suggestion. His robe hung by the door. The po' boys were still warm and delicious. After a few bites and a round of small talk, Noose asked,
"Do you have your calendars?"
Both nodded and reached into their briefcases. Noose looked at some notes and asked,
"How does December the 10th sound for the retrial?"
Jake had nothing scheduled past October. Dyer's trial calendar revolved around Noose's. Both said they were clear for December 10th.
"Any idea where it might be?"
Jake asked, hoping fervently that it would not happen again in Van Buren County.
"Well, I've been thinking about that,"
Noose said as he took a bite and wiped his mouth with a paper napkin.
"We should keep this show on the road. Things didn't work out too well in Chester. We're not doing it here. Tyler County is Lowell's backyard, so it's out. That leaves Polk and Milburn counties. I'll pick one in due course, and we'll tee it up there. Any objections?"
Lowell said, "Well, of course, Judge, we'll oppose any motion for a change of venue."
Neither side was eager for a rematch. Dyer feared another loss, and Jake was worried about a possible bankruptcy.
"Of course you will," Noose said, "but don't spend a lot of time opposing it."
And with that, the court had ruled. His Honor kept eating and talking.
"Not that it matters, we could pick 12 people off the streets in any of the 5 counties and get the same result. Gentlemen, I've thought of little else since the mistrial, and I do not believe any jury will convict this boy, nor will any jury acquit him. I'd like to hear your thoughts."
Jake nodded and demurred, and Dyer said,
"Well, we certainly have to try again, don't we? I can see the same challenges, but I'm confident of getting a conviction."
The standard response from every prosecutor.
"Jake?"
"I agree with you, Judge. The votes may vary a little, probably not an even split, but a unanimous verdict is not imaginable. The only fact that will change is that Kira will give birth next month, so there'll be a child. We, of course, will have the blood test to prove it's Kofor's."
"And there's no chance otherwise?"
Dyer asked politely. "I believe the girl," Jake said.
"So you'll lose the ambush angle?"
"Maybe. Or maybe I have another one."
"Gentlemen, we'll try him again on December the 10th, and there will be no more ambushes. If the jury cannot agree, then we'll go from there. No chance of a plea agreement."
Dyer shook his head and said,
"Not now, Judge. I can't agree to a plea to anything less than capital murder, not for a dead officer."
"Jake?"
"Same. I can't ask a 16-year-old boy to agree to a deal that gives him the next 30 or so years in prison."
"I assumed as much. Gentlemen, I see no way out of this mess. The facts are what they are, and we can't change them. We have no choice but to keep trying."
Jake pushed his sandwich away and reached for some papers.
"I guess that brings us to the issue of bail. So far, my client has served 5 months for nothing. He is, as we all know, presumed to be innocent. The state has tried once to prove him guilty, and the state failed. It is not fair to keep him locked up.
He is as innocent as we are, not to mention he's a minor, and he deserves the chance to get out. Dyer shook his head as he took a bite. Noose surprisingly said,
This has been on my mind, too. It's troubling.
It's worse than that, Judge. The kid was 2 years behind in school back in March. As we've learned, his education has been rather spotty. He's now incarcerated far away from any classroom.
I thought your wife was working with him.
Several hours a week, Judge, and it's a temporary arrangement at best. It's not enough. The kid has shown some interest in learning, but he needs to be in a real school with teachers and other kids and with lots of tutoring after hours. Jake handed both some paperwork. This is a petition for a writ of habeas corpus I plan to file on Monday in circuit court. And I'll ask you, Judge, with all due respect, to recuse yourself. If we fail in circuit court, then I'll go to federal and get some relief. The kid is being unlawfully detained, and I can convince a federal judge of that. The petition claims a violation of the Eighth Amendment prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment on the grounds that he is a minor being held in an adult facility and in solitary confinement and with no access to educational resources. We found two cases on point from other jurisdictions, and they're covered in our brief. If we get relief and get him out, then both of you can blame someone else and not worry about any political fallout. This irritated Noose, and he flashed an angry look at Jake.
I don't think about the politics, Jake.
Well, you're the first politician who doesn't think about the politics.
I'm offended. Do you consider me a politician, Jake?
Not really, but your name will be on the ballot next year. Yours too, Lowell.
I don't allow politics to enter my considerations, Jake, Lowell said a bit too piously.
Then why not let him out? Jake shot back. They took a deep breath as Noose and Dyer skimmed the petition. They were obviously caught off guard and not sure what they were reading. After a moment, Jake said to Noose, I'm sorry if I offended you, Judge. I did not intend to.
Apology accepted. We need to be honest here and agree that allowing a capital murder defendant out of jail would upset a lot of people. Do you have a plan?
Yes. An appearance bond is used to ensure that a person accused of a crime will show up and face the charges. I promise you both that if and when you want Drew, his mother, or his sister to appear in any court, they will be there. You have my word. My plan is to get him out and take him to Oxford, where Josie and Kira are living, and get him in school in a couple of weeks. Kira will start school after she has the baby. No one knows them over there, though I guess their address is now in the record. Both Drew and Kira need tutoring and some counseling, and I'll try to arrange things.
Is the mother working? Noose asked.
She has two part-time jobs and is looking for a third. I found him a small apartment, and I'm helping with the rent. This will continue as long as I don't go broke.
There has to be a secured bond, Jake. How can they afford it?
Jake handed him a document and said, This is the deed to my home. I'll put it up as security. And I'm not afraid to do so because I know that Drew will appear in court.
Come on, Jake, Dyer said, shaking his head. You can't do that, Jake, Noose said.
There's the deed, Judge. Mind you, the house is heavily mortgaged, like everything else I own, but I'm not worried.
What if they skip out again? Dyer asked. They have a history of living on the run. Then I'll track down the little asshole and haul him back to jail.
The humor hit where it was supposed to, and they enjoyed a good laugh.
What's the value of the house? Noose asked.
I have one of those friendly drive-by appraisals at $300,000, and a mortgage to match it dollar for dollar.
We're not using your house, Jake. What if I set the bond at $50,000?
No, sir. That means we, or I, will have to scrounge up $5,000 cash for the bondsman. It's a racket and we all know it. Right now, I don't have $5,000 to spare. Take the deed, Judge. The kid'll be in court when he's called. Noose tossed his copy of the deed on the table.
Lowell,
the state will oppose any bail for this defendant. It is capital murder. Thanks for nothing, Jake said. Noose slapped a hand to his chin and began scratching.
All right. The deed will suffice.
Jake reached for more papers and handed them over. I've already prepared an order for you to sign. I'll talk to the clerk in just a moment. Then I'll talk to Ozzy, if he'll take my call, and arrange the transfer. I'll pick up the kid first thing in the morning and take him to Oxford. Look, we were friends when this started, and we'll be friends when it's over. I need your help in keeping this as quiet as possible. Josie owes money and has already been served with lawsuits. Kira is having a child out of wedlock, but no one in Oxford knows anything about it. I'd like her to start school as just another 14-year-old girl, not a young mother. And there might be some people who would like nothing more than to find Drew walking down the street. Secrecy is important here.
Understood, Dyer said.
Noose waved him off as if he didn't need the warnings. Lucian wanted a Friday afternoon drink on his porch and was pushy about the invitation. Jake didn't want to hang around his office, and after he finally got Ozzy on the phone and worked out the details of the release, he drove over and parked behind the old Porsche. Lucian, of course, was sitting in his rocker, drink in hand, and Jake wondered how many he had already knocked back. Jake took a seat in another rocker, and they chatted about the heat and humidity. Normally, Sally would eventually materialize and ask about a beverage, then bring one as if she was doing him a favor. Lucian said,
I invited you for a drink. The bar hasn't moved, and there's beer in the fridge.
Jake left and returned with a bottle of beer. They drank for a while and listened to the crickets. Finally, Jake said,
You wanted to talk about something.
Yes. Reuben stopped by yesterday.
Judge Attlee?
How many Reubens do you know around here?
Why are you always the smartass?
Practice.
I actually know another Reuben, Winslow. He goes to our church, so you wouldn't know him.
Now who's the smartass?
It's a defensive measure.
Reuben and I go way back. We've had our differences, but we still talk.
It would be impossible to find any lawyer, judge, or elected official in Clanton who had not had their differences with Lucian Wilbanks. And what's on his mind?
He's worried about you. You know Reuben. He fancies himself as the shepherd of all legal matters in town and quietly keeps up with things. Little happens in the courthouse that he doesn't know about. He knew almost as much about the gamble trial as I did, and I was in the courtroom.
Sounds like Reuben.
He was not surprised at the hung jury, nor was I. They can try that boy 10 times and won't get a conviction or an acquittal. Your defense was masterful, Jake. I watched you with great pride.
Thank you.
Jake was touched, because compliments from Lucian were rare. Criticism was the norm.
A strange case indeed. Impossible to convict, impossible to acquit. I'm sure they'll try again.
December 10th, either in Smithfield or Temple.
Lucian absorbed this and took a drink.
Meanwhile, he sits in jail, an innocent boy.
No. He gets out in the morning.
How'd you do that?
I didn't. Portia did.
She prepared a habeas corpus petition, wrote a compelling brief, and I showed it to Noose this morning. I threatened him with it, said I would file it here, then take it federal.
Lucian laughed for a long time, rattling his ice. When the humor passed, he said,
"Anyway, back to Reuben. He's bothered by some things. Smallwood. He doesn't like the railroad and thinks it has operated dangerously around here for decades. He told me that 30 years ago, a friend of his came within an inch of hitting a train at that same crossing. Guy got lucky and avoided an accident. Reuben has had Central in court a few times over the years, condemnation suits and such. He finds its people arrogant and stupid and just doesn't care for the company."
"I have the documents," Jake said casually, though he had perked up considerably.
"And he's bothered by the mystery witness. What's his name?"
"Neil Nickel."
"Reuben being Reuben, he's read the court file from front to back, and he's bothered by the fact that this guy was at the scene for 3 hours, cops everywhere, and he said nothing. Then he went home and hoped it would go away. Then he showed up the Friday before the trial wanting to testify. That strikes Reuben as being unfair."
"Well, it was definitely a shock. But why is Reuben reading the court file? Surely he has enough work on his desk."
"Says he reads files for pleasure. And he's bothered by the child, the family's only survivor, and is worried about her future. You set up the guardianship in Reuben's court, and he approved it, so he has a right to be concerned. He wants the child taken care of."
"The child is being raised by Sarah Smallwood's sister. It's a decent home. Not great, but okay." Lucian drained his glass and stood slowly. Jake watched him walk away as if cold sober and knew that the story was far from over. If it was headed in the right direction, Jake's entire future might improve dramatically. Suddenly anxious, he gulped his beer and thought about fetching another. Lucian returned with a fresh whiskey and began rocking again.
"Anyway, Reuben doesn't like the way the case is going."
"Nor do I. I'm in debt because of it."
"A good strategy might be to non-suit the case in circuit court, then refile in chancery."
"The old non-suit trick," Jake said. "We studied it in law school. A non-suit allowed a plaintiff to file a lawsuit, then dismiss it for any reason under the sun before a verdict, then refile it when convenient. Sue, and if discovery goes badly, non-suit, and walk away. Sue, get to trial, get a rough-looking jury, then non-suit, and fight another day." There was a famous case from the Gulf Coast in which a plaintiff's lawyer panicked when jury deliberations dragged on and he thought he was about to lose. He announced a non-suit and everybody went home. The next day, it was revealed that the jury had just decided to give his client a generous verdict. He refiled, tried the case a year later, and lost. His client sued him for malpractice and won. Defense lawyers hated the rule. Plaintiff's lawyers knew it was unfair, but fought to keep it. Most states had moved on to more modern procedures.
"What an archaic rule," Jake said.
"True, but it's still on the books. Use it to your advantage."
Jake finished his beer. It was obvious that Lucian was in no hurry and was enjoying the moment. Jake asked, "And what might happen in chancery?"
"Good things. Reuben assumes jurisdiction of the case because of the guardianship and his responsibility to protect the child. He sets a trial date, and off you go."
"A bench trial, no jury."
"Correct. The defense might request a jury, but Reuben will say no."
Jake took a deep breath and said,
"I need a shot of that brown stuff."
"The bar hasn't moved. Careful, though, or your wife might hit you."
"My wife might be drinking, too, when she hears this."
He left and returned with a Jack on Ice. If you will recall, Lucian, Harry Rex and I debated this very issue before we filed suit. I think you might have been in the room during one or two of our conversations. We decided to avoid Chancery Court because the Honorable Reuben Attlee is so damn tight-fisted with money. To him, a $100,000 verdict is obscene, a violation of the rules of an orderly society. He's a miser, a skinflint, a cheapskate. Lawyers have to beg to get a few bucks for their guardians.
He was generous to you during the Hubbard Will contest.
He was, and we talked about that too. But there was so much money on the table, it was easier to be generous. We filed Smallwood in circuit court because we liked our chances better with a jury.
True, Jake, and you wanted a big courtroom victory, a record-setting verdict that would put you on the map as a trial lawyer.
I did.
Still do. Well, you're not getting that verdict with Smallwood, not in circuit court.
So Judge Attlee wants to preside over the trial?
There won't be a trial, Jake. He'll force the railroad to settle, something he's very good at. He did it with Hubbard.
He did, but after I won the trial,
and the settlement was fair. Everybody got something, and the appeals were avoided, right?
Right.
Same here. Refile in Chancery, and Reuben will take over. He'll protect the child, and the lawyers, too.
Jake took a long sip, then closed his eyes and rocked gently. He could feel the pressure lift from his shoulders, the stress ooze from his pores. The alcohol was settling in, and his breathing relaxed. For the first time in months, there was a light in the distance. The fact that Judge Attlee was sitting in the same rocker 24 hours earlier and telling Lucian what he should tell young Jake was difficult to absorb. But then it sounded just like Reuben. Chapter 54.
Ozzie was waiting at the jail when Jake arrived early Saturday morning. He was cordial enough, but did not offer a handshake. Mr. Zack fetched the prisoner, and Drew appeared at the desk with an army surplus duffel stuffed with everything he owned. Jake signed several forms, and Drew signed an inventory sheet. They followed Ozzie through a back door to where Jake was parked. Outside, Drew stopped for a second and looked around. His first taste of freedom in almost 5 months. When Jake opened his driver's door, Ozzie said,
"How about lunch next week?"
"I'd like that, Ozzie. Anytime."
They drove away without being seen, and 5 minutes later parked in Jake's driveway. Carla met them on the patio and grabbed Drew for a long, fierce hug. They went inside to the kitchen where a feast was being prepared. Jake led him downstairs to his bathroom and gave him a towel.
"Take a hot shower as long as you want, then we'll have breakfast."
Drew emerged half an hour later with wet hair, wearing a cool Springsteen t-shirt, denim shorts, and a pair of brand new Nikes, which he said fit perfectly. Jake handed him $3 $1 bills and said,
"For blackjack, keep the change."
He looked at the money and said,
"Come on, Jake, you don't owe me anything."
"Take the money. You want it fair and square, and I always pay my gambling debts."
Drew reluctantly took the money and sat at the table where Hannah was waiting. Her first question was,
"What was it like in jail?"
Jake said, No. We're not talking about jail. Pick another topic."
"It was awful," he said.
Over the course of the summer, Drew and Carla had spent many hours together studying history and science and reading mysteries, and they had become close. She placed a plate of pancakes and bacon in front of him and ruffled his hair.
"Your mom's going to get you a haircut as soon as you get home."
He smiled and said,
"I can't wait. And it's a real apartment, right?"
It is, Jake said. It's not very big, but it'll do. You'll like it over there, Drew.
I can't wait.
He crammed a piece of bacon into his mouth.
What was the food like in jail?
Hannah asked, staring at him. Hannah, eat your breakfast and no talk about jail. Drew demolished a stack of pancakes and asked for more. At first, he said little, but was soon chatting away as he ate. The pitch of his voice rose and fell and squeaked at times. He had grown at least 2 inches since April, and though still rail thin, he was looking more and more like a normal teenager. Puberty was finally arriving. When he was stuffed, he thanked Carla, gave her another fierce hug, and said he wanted to go see his mother. On the road to Oxford, he grew quiet as he took in the sights with a pleasant smile. Halfway there, he began to nod and soon fell asleep. Jake watched him and couldn't help but wonder about his future. He knew how precarious Drew's freedom would be. He did not share Noose and Lucian's confidence that a conviction was unlikely. The next trial would be different. They always were. A different courtroom, a different jury, different tactics by the state. Regardless of a win, a loss, or another draw, Jake knew that Drew Gamble would be part of his life for years to come. On Monday, Jake non-suited the Smallwood case in circuit court and sent a copy to opposing counsel. Walter Sullivan called his office 3 times that afternoon, but Jake was not in the mood to chat. He owed no explanation. On Tuesday, he filed a wrongful death lawsuit in Chancery Court and faxed a copy to Judge Attlee. On Wednesday, the Times, as expected, ran a front-page story under the headline, "Kofor Suspect Released from Jail." Dumas Lee did him no favors. His reporting was slanted and gave the impression that the defendant was being treated with leniency. Most galling was his reliance on comments made by former district attorney Rufus Buckley, who said, among other cheap shots, that he was shocked that Judge Noose would allow the release of a man indicted for capital murder. "It's unheard of in this state," Buckley said, as if he knew the history in all 82 counties. Not once did Dumas mention the fact that the defendant was presumed to be innocent. Nor had he bothered to call Jake for a comment. Jake figured he had offered so many no comments that Dumas was tired of asking. True to form, Buckley seemed to have plenty of time to talk. He had never met a reporter he didn't like. On Thursday, Judge Noose convened the trial in the matter of Jake Brigance versus Ford County. The main courtroom was practically empty. The 5 supervisors sat together in a front row, arms crossed over their chests, their frustration evident as they all glowered at Jake, the enemy. They were veteran politicians who had ruled the county for years with little turnover in their ranks. Each came from a specified district, a little fiefdom, where the boss doled out paving contracts, equipment purchases, and jobs. As a group, they were not accustomed to being shoved around, not even by a judge. Dumas Lee was there to snoop and watch the show. Jake refused to look at him, but really wanted to curse him. His honor began with, "Mr. Brigance, you're the plaintiff. Do you have any witnesses?" Jake stood and said, "No, Your Honor, but for the record, I would like to say that I was appointed by the court to represent Mr. Drew Gamble in his capital murder trial. He was and still is quite indigent. I would like to introduce into evidence my statement of fees and expenses for his defense." Jake walked to the court reporter and handed over the paperwork. "So admitted," Noose said. Jake sat down, and Todd Tannehill stood and said, "Your Honor, I represent the county, the defendant, and acknowledge receipt of Mr. Brigance's bill, which I submitted to the board. Pursuant to the Mississippi Code, the maximum to be paid by any county in such a matter is $1,000.
The county is prepared to tender a check for this amount.
Noose said, "Very well. I'd like for Mr. Patrick East to come to the witness stand."
East was the current president of the board and was obviously surprised to be called. He made his way forward, was sworn in, and settled into the witness chair. He smiled at Omar, a man he had known 20 years. Judge Noose asked a few preliminary questions to establish his name, address, and position, then picked up some papers.
"Now, Mr. East, looking at the county's budget for this fiscal year, I see that there is a surplus of some $200,000. Can you explain that?"
"Sure, Judge. It's just good management, I guess."
East smiled at his colleagues. By nature, he was folksy and funny, and the voters loved him.
"Okay. And there is a line item labeled discretionary account. The balance is $80,000. Could you explain that?"
"Sure, Judge. It's sort of a rainy day fund. We use it occasionally when there is an unexpected expense. For example, well, last month, we needed new lights at the softball complex over in Caraway. It wasn't in the budget request, and we voted to spend $11,000. Just stuff like that."
"Are there any restrictions on how this money can be spent?"
"Not really. As long as the request is proper and approved by our attorney."
"Thank you. Now, when the board was presented with Mr. Braganza's bill, how did the five of you vote?"
5-0 against it."
"We're just following the law, Your Honor."
"Thank you."
Noose looked at the two lawyers and asked,
"Any questions?"
Without standing, both shook their heads in the negative.
"Very well, Mr. East, you are excused."
He returned to his colleagues on the front row. Noose said,
"Anything else?"
Jake and Todd had nothing.
"Very well. The court finds in favor of the plaintiff, Jake Braganza, and orders the defendant, Ford County, to proffer a check in the amount of $21,000. We are adjourned."
On Friday, Todd Tannehill called Jake with the news that he had been ordered by the board to appeal the decision. He apologized and said he had no choice but to do what his client wanted. An appeal to the state Supreme Court would take 18 months. Friday was Portia's last day at work. She would start classes on Monday, and she was ready to go. Lucian, Harry Rex, Bev, Jake, and Carla gathered with her in the main conference room and opened a bottle of champagne. They toasted her with a few light roasts in between, and each took a turn with a little speech. Jake went last and suddenly had a knot in his throat. The gift was a handsome chestnut and bronze plaque that read, "Office of Portia Carol Lang, Attorney at Law." It was to be mounted on the door of the office she had occupied for the past 2 years. She held it proudly, wiped her eyes, looked at the group, and said,
"I'm overwhelmed. But then I've been overwhelmed many times around here. I thank you for your friendship. You have been dear. But I also thank you for something far more important. It is your acceptance. You have accepted me, a young black woman, as an equal. You have given me an incredible opportunity, and you have expected me to perform as an equal. Because of your encouragement and acceptance, I have a future that at times I cannot believe. You have no idea what this means to me. Thank you. I love you all, even you, Lucian."
There were no dry eyes when she finished. Chapter 55. On the third Sunday in September, with the summer heat finally breaking and a hint of autumn in the air, the Braganza family, running late as usual, was trying to leave for services at the Good Shepherd Bible Church. Carla and Hannah were in the car, and Jake was about to set the house alarm when the phone rang. It was Josie, anxious with the news that Kira was in labor. She was in a hurry and promised to call when she could. Jake calmly set the alarm, locked the door, and got in the car.
"We're even later," Carla growled.
"The phone rang," he said, backing out of the driveway.
"Who was it?"
"Josie. The hour has come." Carla took a deep breath and mumbled,
"She's early."
They had not yet told Hannah. The child missed nothing, and from the back seat she asked,
"Is Miss Josie okay?"
"She's fine," Jake said. "It was nothing."
"Then why'd she call?"
"It was nothing." After a sermon that seemed far too long, they visited with Pastor McGarry and Meg for a moment, then got away. They hustled home and ate a quick lunch while staring at the phone. Hours passed. Hannah's birth had been a nightmare, and they remembered all the things that could go wrong. Jake tried to watch a football game while Carla puttered in the kitchen, as close to the phone as possible. Finally, at 4:30, Josie called with the news that the baby had arrived. Kira had been a rock star. Mother and child were doing fine with no complications. 7 pounds, 4 ounces, and of course, he was beautiful and looked just like his mother. Hannah knew something strange was going on and watched every move. On Monday, she and her mother left for school as usual. Jake was at his office reviewing paperwork. He called his attorney in Oxford, a friend from law school, and they walked through their plan. He called his parents with the news. Carla had called hers Sunday night. After school, they dropped off Hannah at a friend's house and drove to the hospital in Oxford. Kira's room was a wreck because both Josie and Drew had spent the night there on fold-away beds. The family was ready to go home. Drew seemed particularly bored with it all. At Jake's insistence, Kira had not seen her baby. He walked them through the procedures and explained the legalities. Kira was emotional and cried through most of the meeting. Carla stood by her bed and patted her arm. She looked even younger than 14.
"That poor child,"
Carla said, wiping her cheeks as they left the room and walked away.
"That poor child."
Jake almost said something banal, like the worst was behind them and now they could move on. But with Drew's legal problems hanging like a sword, it was difficult to be optimistic. By the time they got to the maternity ward, though, the sadness was gone. After a quick peek at the baby, they declared him to be just perfect. That night, they finally sat down with Hannah and broke the news that she was about to get a little brother. Her days as the only child were coming to an end. She was thrilled and had 1,000 questions, and for hours they talked about his arrival and his name and his room and on. Jake and Carla had decided to postpone any discussion of the mother's identity. They described her only as a beautiful young girl who couldn't keep her baby. This mattered little to Hannah. She was ecstatic over the idea of her new brother. Jake worked late into the night assembling a new crib they had hidden in a storage closet, while Carla and Hannah unwrapped new gowns and blankets and baby clothes. Hannah insisted on sleeping with them that night, not an unusual occurrence, and they almost had to muzzle her to get some sleep. They awoke early for the big day and dressed like they were going to church. Hannah helped pack a diaper bag with more stuff than any newborn could possibly need. She chattered all the way to Oxford while her parents tried in vain to answer all her questions. At the hospital, they parked her in a waiting room with strict instructions and stopped by to see the administrator who reviewed the paperwork and signed off. They went to Kira's room and found her and Josie packed and ready to leave. Drew was already at school. The doctor had signed the discharge forms, and the Gambles had had enough of the hospital. With hugs and tears, they said goodbye and promised to get together soon. Then they raced to the maternity ward to collect the boy. The nurse handed him over to Carla, who was speechless, and they hurried away to the waiting room where they presented him to his big sister. Hannah, finally, was speechless too. For a moment, she cuddled him like a doll and insisted that he wear a soft blue outfit, one that she had selected and that was more appropriate for the occasion. They would call him Luke, a name that Hannah approved. On his amended birth certificate, his legal name would be Lucian, a name that Carla had at first resisted. Naming their child after the biggest rogue in Clanton might present all sorts of problems, but Jake was adamant. By the time the kid was 10, Lucian Wilbanks would be gone and forgotten by most of the town. Jake, though, would treasure his memories for the rest of his life. They drove to the square and parked in front of the office of Arnie Pierce, a close friend of Jake's from their law school days. Before she met Jake, Carla had once dated Arnie, so the relationships were old and trusted. They walked across the street to the Lafayette County Courthouse, where Pierce had arranged a special appointment with Chancellor Purvis Wesson, a youthful judge Jake knew well. They gathered in his chambers for a private hearing with a court reporter present. Like a priest at a christening, Judge Wesson held the baby, examined him, and declared him ready to be adopted. Portia arrived just in time for the occasion. 3 weeks into the grind of law school, she was more than willing to skip a class or two and witness the adoption. With Arnie feeding him paperwork, Judge Wesson waived the 3-day waiting period and the 6 months probation. He examined the petition and the consent forms signed by Josie and Kira. For the record, he read the specifics from the father's death certificate. He signed his name twice, and little Luke Brigantz became the legal son of Jake and Carla. The final matter was an order locking up the file and keeping it away from the public records. 30 minutes later, they posed for photos and said goodbye. For the ride home, Hannah insisted that Carla ride in the rear seat with her and her brother. She had already assumed possession of the child and wanted to give him a bottle. Then she wanted to change his diaper, something Jake heartily endorsed. She could change all of them she wanted. The drive to Clanton was a joyous moment, something Jake and Carla would relive for years. At home, lunch was waiting, along with Jake's parents and Carla's, who had flown into Memphis early that morning. Harry Rex and Lucian arrived for the homecoming. When Jake announced the child's name, Harry Rex feigned irritation and asked indignantly why Lucian was chosen. Jake explained that one Harry Rex in the world was more than sufficient. The grandmothers took turns squeezing the boy, all under the watchful eyes of his big sister. The friends and family would go to great lengths to bury as many of the details as possible. People would talk, though, and the town would eventually know. Jake didn't care. Author's note. I began writing A Time to Kill in 1984 and published it in 1989. A long time passed before Jake returned in 2013 in Sycamore Row. In between, other books set in the same fictional place were published: The Chamber, The Last Juror, The Summons, and my only collection of short stories, Ford County. Now, with the addition of this novel, a lot has been written about Clanton and many of its characters: Jake and Carla, Harry Rex, Lucian, Judge Noose, Judge Attlee, Sheriff Ozzie Walls, Carl Lee, and so on. Indeed, I've written so much about Ford County that I can't remember all of it. The point of all this is to apologize for any mistakes. I'm just too lazy to go back and read the earlier books. Thanks to some old lawyer pals in Hernando who helped me remember details from an earlier career. James Franks, William Ballard, Chancellor Percy Lynchard. They explained the laws correctly. If I modified them to fit the story, then so be it. It's my error, not theirs. The same is true for any number of statutes and procedural rules in my home state. As a young attorney so many years ago, I was bound to follow them to the letter of the law. Now, as a writer of fiction, I feel no such bondage. Here, as before, I have changed laws, twisted them, even fabricated them, all in an effort to drive the narrative. And a big special thanks to Judy Jacoby for the title. This is Michael Beck. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of A Time for Mercy by John Grisham. This program was directed by Jessica Kay, executive producer Orly Moskowitz, edited by Tim Bader Audio. Text copyright 2020 by Belfry Holdings, Inc. Production copyright 2020, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.